Natural Resources for Wednesday, April 25th, 2007. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 5022, the Department of Environmental Quality Budget Bill, and House Bill 5023, the Department of Environmental Quality Fee Ratification Bill. Ms. Hollicky, she's already forward. Go ahead and start it when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Stephanie Hallick, the Director of DEQ. And with me today is Andy Ginsberg, the Air Quality Administrator, and also Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services. And I'm wondering if you want to change your sequence since you have a few more quotes.
Are you here?
Yep.
Okay.
Are you here?
I'm here. I was the first one. I just want everybody to know.
That's a deep question, Mr. Chair.
Somebody Sorry. Asked me when this session will end, and I said when it's over.
That's not a
response. But with that, we will recess the two public hearings on 5022, 5023, open a work session on the federal grant application. Mr. Siever.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have at your place a copy of the LFO analysis of the grant application and a copy of the request letter. The department is submitting essentially four federal grant applications to US EPA that total $180,000 for a number of pollution prevention and sustainability projects, and the agency's here to describe those in a little bit more detail for you.
Okay. Please proceed. Identify Chair, yourself for the record.
Yes. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Kippett. I'm the Land Quality Administrator with DEQ. As Paul mentioned, we're asking for your approval or authorization to apply for a grant to EPA for pollution prevention activities. That's $180,000 total. There are four separate pieces to this grant application. I'll run through them very quickly and talk a little bit about the budget part of this. First one is integrating sustainability within DEQ. This is to provide some training opportunities for staff to really get at sustainability issues within our agency and serve as sort of the cutting-edge leaders in the agency to promote sustainability within DEQ and our operations and programs. The second aspect is a wood-burning device education. This is for internal wood stoves in residences, working with individuals and businesses on giving them information on what's appropriate to burn and how best to burn them so airborne toxics can be reduced. Third aspect is Oregon School's vehicle idling reduction project. There we're trying to work with schools to, based in Portland schools, and Oregon Department of Transportation and other businesses will support this to reduce bus and other school-related vehicle idling time. And then finally, the fourth aspect of this grant proposal is Oregon Auto Body Outreach. This is really working with auto body shops to reduce toxics, greenhouse and other gases, and hazardous waste beyond levels required by law. One thing that's a little different from this particular kind of grant, the pollution prevention grants, require a significant match. So the $180,000 in grant funds need to be matched dollar for dollar. The good news is that most of this will be covered, about $135,000 of staff time, where staff will be involved in these projects and would be anyway. So it's not a burden on our agency to count that staff time as match. The rest of it, about $45,000, is coming from actual dollar contributions from businesses and others that support this grant application. With that, I'd open it up to any questions if you have any.
Yes, Representative Garrard. Could you explain what adhere to the principles of sustainability is?
Well, Representative Garrard, members of the committee, that, you know, sustainability in terms of our practices and our efforts in the programs within DEQ, what we're looking for is what kinds of actions can we best promote within all of our programs, air, water, and land, that allow for sustainable practices to grow in Oregon. So it could be promoting green building standards. It could be working with our own operations and how are we doing in terms of energy use within DEQ facilities. There's it basically is a wide range of activities that we're looking at to get our folks some training on.
Thank
here, just to follow up. Are the principles of sustainability printed anywhere? I mean, are they...
I think they are in the sustainability plan, Representative Burley, Chair Devlin, and we also, as one of our strategic directions for DEQ, is to be promoting sustainability. So what I'm trying to say, and maybe not very well, is that while this is a new area and we don't have all the details necessarily fleshed out, it's an aspect, if we're trying to operate our agency and look at how we operate our programs in ways that promote long-term longevity in an environmentally sound way, we need to get some of our staff trained in this.
Mr. Chair, could I just add one thing? If I could, this is sort of a lead by example. All agencies are required to do a sustainability plan. We have one. We would be happy to share it with the committee if you're interested in having a copy. And our feeling is that if we're going to ask others or adopt policies that affect others to have sustainable practices, that we ought to be looking at ourselves and making sure that we are using those as well.
Yes, Representative Brown.
And going to the fourth bullet, this one's kind of scary. It says it would encourage these businesses to adopt procedures that go beyond those required by law. And then further on down in the paragraph, it describes it would be done in two phases. The first, funded by this grant, would prepare the materials and implement the changes. That doesn't sound voluntary to me.
Representative Garrard, Chair Devlin, when we say implement, what we're talking about here, there's some specific equipment that auto body shops use. This is the STAR part of this grant. That would be the implementation part, is to put this equipment in community college and colleges and train students and businesses how to use this auto body equipment. So it's not implementing the whole program and forcing people to do this, but it's implementing the technology in a way that we can then show people how it can be used to save them money.
Anything additional? Do we have a motion to recommend to the full?
Mr. Chair, I move... is it adoption or recommendation, approval of this grant for DEQ to apply for federal pollution prevention funds?
Okay. So I move to recommend approval of this grant to the Full Ways and Means Committee. Is there any additional discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, Representative Burley. I got a problem.
Well, I don't, Mr. Chair, I'm not, as a courtesy here for you, I'm not going to object, but I just go on record saying if this were state dollars, I would absolutely oppose this. I mean, some of this stuff is, to me, just makes no sense at all. But it's federal dollars, so I'll give you the vote.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Burley. With that, the motion passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I just wanted to clarify one thing procedurally, that you're seeing a number of grants rolled into one. Because of the way the EPA program works, they have basically two steps. They have a pre-application stage where they ask applicants to come up with ideas. So it's almost like a fishing expedition. So the department comes up with a number of ideas that they have. They send them into EPA. EPA looks them over and decides which ones they're most interested in, and then asks the agency then to actually apply for a grant at that point. And that's when the official application goes in. We don't normally bring the fishing expedition piece to you in front of you where you see a bunch of them, but because of timing, it's likely the EPA won't decide until September which ones they're interested in, and with uncertainty in the interim, we decided to go ahead with these four.
Okay.
I couldn't let him throw that out there. It's a fishing expedition at the taxpayer's expense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, that is true, and I think that they're looking to see which initiatives the EPA is most interested in pursuing that federal fiscal year.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you
for your acknowledgement.
I will take the dangerous mission and carry this to the floor.
We admire you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll close that work session. reopen the hearing on House Bill 5022 and 5023, and we're back to start again. We're in air quality, and tell us where you're going to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of DEQ, and with me is Lisa Pearson from Department of Administrative Services and Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator, who will pick up the presentation from where we left off yesterday.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And yesterday we were looking at tab C, page 1 of the white binder, and we already covered the left-hand side of the figure, which showed our success in meeting federal air quality standards as they existed up until this year. And then we talked already about the first two challenges, fine particulate, where EPA has set a new standard for fine particulate, and the fact that Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge are violating that standard, a number of other areas on the edge. And we also already talked about the diesel and toxics challenge, where we have every county in Oregon with one or more pollutants over health benchmarks for air toxics, and we acknowledge the work of Representative Dingfelder's committee and Senator Vakian's committee in encouraging EPA to do better on the benzene rule to protect the Northwest. And we were just about to start the Columbia River Gorge, so that's where I'll pick up. The Columbia River Gorge is a national scenic area created by an act of Congress, and we are working on an air quality strategy for the gorge, and as you know, air quality in the Columbia River Gorge is very controversial, and any strategy there needs to balance the needs of residents and businesses and farmers and visitors. DEQ and our sister agencies in Washington are just completing an extensive technical study about air quality in the gorge. What's the air quality like? Is it getting better or worse? What's causing the air pollution there? And that study will be finished this summer. And so we have a policy package that will help us take the next steps, which would be to work with the community and see what they want to do about air quality next. So that's another significant challenge, and I'll be talking about that shortly. And finally, the last major challenge I'd like to highlight is climate change. Climate change, which is caused by emissions of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide. And this body has focused quite a bit on climate change this session with a number of bills to address energy, power generation, energy conservation, biofuels. And as you know, climate change is expected to have a number of significant impacts on Oregon, ranging from flooding, reduced snow packs, lower farm and forest productivity, public health impacts. And so we have a number of steps underway that the governor's proposed, that this body is considering. The Department of Energy is responsible primarily for the energy and power side of the equation, and DEQ is responsible more for greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. So I'll be talking about some policy packages to get at that part of the puzzle. And with that, I can move on to the next page unless there are questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Okay, so if you could turn to page 2 of tab C. Before I jump into our policy packages, I just wanted to orient you to our air quality budget overall, and if you could focus first on the pie chart in the center at the top of the page, you'll see the governor's recommended budget of $54.1 million for air quality, and that is an increase from $45.1 million last biennium, or in this current biennium, and that increase of $9 million, half of that is $4.5 million for the Clean Diesel Initiative, and then the remainder for work by DEQ, the Lane Air Protection Agency, which is responsible, as Stephanie said, for air quality in Lane County, and also local governments to do air quality work. You can also see, if you look at the light blue and yellow slices of that pie, you'll see that air quality is 65% funded by fees, which is similar to the figures that Stephanie gave for the agency as a whole. And of that, about half are vehicle inspection fees. These fees are very important to us because they fund our important programs, but they are dedicated to those programs, and we can't use them for other purposes. And we have really focused on streamlining in all of those programs. And in particular, in vehicle inspection, we have done substantial streamlining there. And as a result, we haven't had to increase the fee in vehicle inspection since 1997. And we won't need to increase it again this next biennium. So we're pretty proud of that accomplishment. We've also done extensive streamlining in our other fee programs. But we still will need to request fee increases in three of our major programs. Fee programs, and I'll be talking about those policy packages shortly. And now if I could have you look at the bar chart on the bottom left-hand side of that page, you'll see positions that are budgeted on federal funds and general funds. And if you look from the 9901 biennium on the left-hand side down to the modified essential budget level, the MEBL, you'll see that there's been a significant decline in positions that are budgeted on federal and general funds in air quality. In fact, a reduction of 21 FTE budgeted on general fund and 8 FTE budgeted on federal funds, and that is about half of the positions that we had in 9901. And so given our tremendous challenges ahead, it's very difficult for us to move forward with that level of staffing. The governor's recommended budget would partially replace the losses that we had since 9901. You can see, if you look at the GRB bar, that we come up to a little bit higher than the level we had in 03-05. Those positions would be doing different work than they used to do. They'd be targeted towards tomorrow's challenges rather than yesterday's challenges. But they are important positions to do that work. And then if you look at the last bar, you'll see in the co-chair's budget that the co-chair's level of positions would be approximately the same that we have today. And that is because the co-chair shifted $1.8 million and about 7 FTE from general fund to federal funds. And I didn't include those 7 FTE in the bar for federal funds because there is no revenue available to fund them, and we would have to leave those positions vacant. So I'd like to just explain that a little bit further. If you could look at the pie chart on the bottom right-hand side of that page, and you'll see the three major causes of the decline in federal funds. And the small piece in blue that's called future cuts, that's our forecast of how much federal funds will have next biennium, and we're expecting $200,000 less general funds next biennium than we had in this biennium. And
federal funds.
And we consider that to be a fairly optimistic forecast considering what's going on in the federal budget. But it's a small piece of the overall problem that we see. My understanding is that the co-chairs thought that all of the decline in federal funds was in that small blue box or small blue slice, and that's because we really weren't clear about the reasons in the policy packages. We didn't break it out and explain the reasons for the decline. But actually, the largest part of the decline is in the yellow slice, and those are past cuts. Those are cuts that have actually already happened, and we're going to be feeling the impacts of those cuts for the first time in the next biennium because we had carryover funds before, and we were basically living off the carryover funds. Those are now exhausted, so the full impact of that hits us next biennium. And the remainder, the red piece of the pie, is roll-up costs for positions that are budgeted on federal funds, and we won't be getting an increase in the grant to pay for those. So the entire $1.8 million is not available in federal funds, and that's why we requested to replace that funding with general fund, and that's the difference between the governor's recommended budget and the co-chair's budget. So with that, I can move on to our policy packages, unless there are any questions.
Please proceed.
Okay, turning to page 3 of tab C, I'd like to first talk about our first key budget driver, which is air quality, health, and visibility standards. As I mentioned, one of our major challenges is federal air quality standards. We have Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge violating the new fine particulate standard. Hermiston, Pendleton, Lakeview, and Medford are just below the standard and at risk of violation. And then 8 other communities around the state are above air quality levels of concern. And actually, if you could just for a moment turn to I thought I had the page marked here. To page 23 of tab C. And I'll just, this is another way of looking at the areas around the state that are at risk or over the standard. The red bar, the red line is the standard. And you can see we have several areas that are over the standard. The blue line is the level of concern. If you're above that level, there are probably health effects. And so we've got a number of communities over health levels, a number above the standard, several that are just below the standard. And the other thing I'd like to point out from this chart is you can see that there are, in some cases, many bars, and in some cases, there's only one or two bars. And that means those are the areas where we've lost monitors, where we have less monitoring today than we used to have. So as Representative Garrard pointed out, we're dependent on less and less information to make very important decisions about whether an area is violating the federal standard or not. So if we could turn back to page 3. And I'll also remind you that I mentioned that EPA, in addition to having just tightened the fine particulate standard, they're looking at the ozone standard or the smog standard, and we're expecting this biennium that they will likely tighten that as well. So for that challenge, our solution is Policy Package 110 and Senate Bill 338. Policy Package 110 would provide resources for DEQ, LRAP, and local governments to address these challenges. And I really want to emphasize the role of local governments here. We have, in a number of communities, local governments run wood stove curtailment programs and wood stove education programs that are key elements of our air quality improvement plans, and they're dependent on some financial assistance. They do put in their own funds.
We have a question from Rick.
Sorry.
Question, Andy. When we talk about the various, getting back to your tab C, page 23 graph, I was just curious as to what the penalty is for if a monitor turns up missing.
Chair Devlin, Representative Garrard, the penalty is that when you have less data, your statistics aren't as accurate, and you could end up inaccurately classifying an area as non-attainment. A smaller number of high air pollution days could cause you to go into non-attainment because you have less data, and so you've got a higher percentage of the data that you have that has problems. So there's no penalty in the sense of an actual fine, but the penalty is that an area could be designated non-attainment or an area could be missed that has important health impacts.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So let me understand you. If you can't monitor it, then you assume it's exceeding the standards?
Senator Devlin, Representative Garrard, no, we don't make that assumption. Where we have an indication that an area is over the standard, we have to have adequate monitoring to make a determination. So we would essentially have to deploy the resources we have to those areas that we think are closest to the standard or over the standard and make a determination. And I'll talk about what's in our package to help us do that more accurately in just a second.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to emphasize to the committee the importance of this monitoring equipment, because everything hinges on it. And if you don't have good monitoring equipment, you can't do your job, and the communities have a grand possibility of being shortchanged. Okay, thank you.
So on page 3, the policy package 110 includes funding for existing staff that we can no longer afford, and it also would replace some of the resources that we lost since 2001, and they would be targeted towards addressing this fine particulate problem. We would focus first on monitoring to identify problems, identify areas that might be over the standard, and to measure our progress in meeting the standard. We would also focus on conducting the technical studies that are needed to identify what's causing the problem, work with local communities to tailor an air quality improvement plan specific for that community that addresses the problems and is consistent with their values, and then implement the measures. And one of those would be assisted greatly by Senate Bill 338, which would help us reduce emissions from wood stoves. And as it turns out, in most of our areas that are at risk of violating the fine particulate standard, wood stove or residential wood heating emissions are a significant part of the pie, and reducing those emissions is very important in meeting our goals.
Clarification,
yes.
On 110, part of it being funding for positions that you no longer have federal funds for. What's the division in that package between new positions and positions you no longer have?
Mr. Chair, if I may, in the binder that I had, in the pocket of the binder, there was a black and white sheet that I referred to that shows the co-chairs' reductions from packages. And the reductions that the co-chairs, there's a different terminology, I think, that Mr. Siebert gave me to use than that. But for purposes of this discussion, on package 110, the amount that the co-chairs reduce the governor's recommended budget by, both in FTE and dollars, is to account for that federal fund difference. So that is where you can find that information.
And I can also add, if you're asking which part of the package is for existing staff and which is replacing staff that we used to have, we have 3.1 FTE. Our existing staff that would be restored with the funding in this package, and 5 FTE would be to replace staff that we lost since 2001. And I can go into any more detail if you'd like about what those positions
that's
are.
It's a little bit confusing because you said 3.1 is to. Figure this out. You said 3.1.
Those are staff that are on the payroll today that are working at DEQ that we can't afford next biennium.
And 5.0.
5.0 are staff that we lost in previous biennium that we're asking to replace. Okay. The focus of this policy package is to meet key performance measure number 12. Which measures the number of unhealthy air days, as Karen described yesterday and the day before. And the co-chair's budget would cut this package nearly in half, and it would make it virtually impossible to meet our targets. So I can then move on to the second half of this package, still on page 3, which is protecting air quality in the Columbia River Gorge. This August, as I mentioned, we're expecting the completion of a 5-year technical study of air quality in the gorge. This was funded by a federal grant, and it's being conducted by consultants in coordination with air quality agencies in Oregon and Washington. And that study will be completed this summer and reported to the Columbia Gorge Commission. Policy Package 115 would help us take the next step. It would replace one FTE that we lost in 2005 that was purpose of which is to take the results of this study, work with the community, and come up with an air quality plan. And because air quality, as I mentioned, is so controversial in the Columbia River Gorge, it's really important that we have a position to work with the community. We have stakeholders on all sides of this issue, and it's really going to take a lot of coordination by DEQ and the sister agencies in Washington to bring everyone together on what's the best strategy for the gorge. This package also includes one position to conduct visibility monitoring. That's an existing position that we can no longer afford. And the co-chair's budget would cut about a third out of this package, and it would eliminate the existing visibility monitoring position that we need to measure long-term performance.
In general, in terms of this package 115, and there was some sort of associated discussion of this when we did the discussion for the Columbia Gorge Commission, one of the hard things that I have understanding this and the issue of visibility is to what degree, I know you're having a study done, but to what degree is the issue of visibility being impacted by things that are actually outside the gorge? That there may be few things that you can do within the gorge to actually change that issue. I mean, you have about 2 million people, roughly, just to the west.
Senator Devlin, you're absolutely correct. The air quality in the gorge is impacted by sources both inside and outside of the gorge, and it's very important to the residents of the gorge that we acknowledge that regularly. We do have within the gorge two highways, and we've got several cities. We've got several train lines and barges that go up and down the Columbia River. So there are a number of emission sources actually inside the gorge. But there's also the Portland plume, which during the summer moves up into the gorge and impacts the gorge. And then there's also during the east, we have the air emissions coming from the east that impact the gorge as well. And the reason that we had a five-year technical study was to try and sort that all out. It's extremely complicated meteorology, the way air is funneled up and down the gorge. And trying to get a handle on which sources impact the gorge at what time of the year and whether changes in emissions from those sources would benefit the gorge or not is a big technical effort. And we're getting close to the end of that, but we're still having challenges. So you're absolutely right. If there are no other questions on this key driver, I can move on to page 4.
I did want to go back to 110 for a moment. And SB 338, I remember portions of that bill, but I believe it would provide some funding also.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 338 has really three major provisions. One is a requirement that upon sale of a home, if you have an uncertified wood stove, that is a wood stove built before 1985, that you would have to remove it and replace it with some other type of heating device. The second provision would be a fund so that we could help especially low-income people to replace wood stoves, and that fund would be paid for using civil penalties from air quality violations in the asbestos and the open burning program. And then the third element would be to close some loopholes in the federal law where there are certain things that certain types of wood heating devices that are exempt from the federal certification program.
If 338 were not to pass, even if you had the staff, and I know that the staff would be a benefit in other areas, just singling out one area, Oak Ridge. Assumptions are bad, but I would assume the issue in Oak Ridge is particulate and a few others, but it's mostly associated with wood stoves. If you had the staff, but you didn't have the resources, could you really address the issue in Oak Ridge?
Senator Devlin, it would be challenging. We have been working to reduce wood stove emissions over the years without the resources in Senate Bill 338. And part of the problem is that people who are dependent on wood for heating often don't have the resources to upgrade and replace an old functioning wood stove with some other type of heating device. And in some communities, and I believe Oak Ridge is in this category, you don't have the option of natural gas, so moving to electric is quite expensive for heat. Buying a new wood stove could be expensive as well because, in all likelihood...
Natural gas is very expensive now.
Natural gas is expensive as well. In all likelihood, if you upgrade your wood stove, you probably will have to upgrade your chimney to meet today's building codes. So it's very difficult for people without assistance to replace an old wood stove. Over time, as these things wear out, they will turn over. But we found that since 1985, we still have about half of the wood stoves out there, uncertified old stoves that will be around for a long time unless we take action to try and turn them over. So what you end up with is wood stove curtailment programs where you try and forecast the days where you're going to have inversions and the air will be the worst, and then the local government calls a no-burn day, and anyone who's got a backup heat source doesn't burn their wood stove. It's a very imperfect and burdensome way of addressing the problem. It's helped us in the past, but a real solution to address these new, much tighter standards would be to try and get these stoves turned over with cleaner options.
Mr. Siebert. I just had a quick question, Andy. Is the cost for Senate Bill 338 included in Package 110?
Paul, no, it's not. Senate Bill 338 was not in the governor's recommended budget, but the governor is supporting the bill.
the way it's laid out here, it looks like it's a function of that package.
It's. I'm sorry about that. I included it because it's so closely allied in terms of the purpose. But the funding is not included in the package.
I think it's, again, shouldn't make assumptions, but I assume that a number of those items that you identified that would now go into this funding from fines, et cetera, currently go into the general fund.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next.
Shall we move on?
Yeah.
Okay. Page 4 of tab C. So our second key budget driver, and that is toxic air pollution. And I mentioned that was another one of the key challenges that I mentioned earlier. Toxic air pollutants cause cancer and other serious health effects. Of greatest concern in Oregon are diesel exhaust, benzene, and toxic combustion products known as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We're well above health benchmarks for these pollutants in most counties in the state. And these emissions come from a wide variety of sources, including diesel engines, evaporation from gasoline and solvents, open burning, and residential heating. So there is some overlap with the sources that cause fine particulate pollution, but it's not exactly the same. And in 2003, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted an innovative science-based program to address risk from hazardous air pollutants or toxic air pollutants. And then right after that program was adopted, we had a series of budget cuts which made it pretty much impossible for us to implement the program. And so Policy Package 111 would address this. It would provide resources for DEQ and the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency to monitor for toxic air pollutants in Albany and Eugene and Medford. It would give us the resources to do a thorough inventory of what the emissions are and the emission sources of toxic air pollutants, and it would enable us to develop a comprehensive air toxics plan for the Portland area. And we want to focus on Portland first because they have the most pollutants, the most over the benchmarks. And one of the really innovative elements of the program that the Environmental Quality Commission adopted is that it would look at a whole geographic area all at once and say, what can we do most efficiently to reduce toxic air pollutants here, rather than just look pollutant by pollutant or source category by source category. So it's a more efficient way. In fact, it's gotten some national attention, and people are watching to see what we do with this, but we haven't been able to do anything because we haven't had funding. We would also, though, continue with some statewide strategies, such as our successful clean diesel initiative, so we can make progress on protecting health throughout the state while we focus on the Portland metro area. The co-chair's budget would cut this package by about a third, and that would reduce the monitoring network and eliminate resources that we need to develop the air toxic risk reduction plan in Portland.
Chair?
Yes. Very good. Andy, right now, because transportation's rebuilding a lot of bridges on I-5, we're seeing 4 to 5 times the number of diesel trucks on Highway 97. That's got to have some kind of an effect, whether it's significant or not, on the air quality in Eastern Oregon. It seems a little bit unfair if you're monitoring Eastern Oregon and find some violations or some standards exceeded that are caused by the state of Oregon moving traffic from the west side of the mountains to the east side of the mountains. How do you handle something like that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Girard, diesel engines do contribute to the problems in Klamath Falls in terms of fine particulate. They're not the biggest source because a lot of those diesel trucks are moving through. But they are one of the pieces of the pie, with Woodstoves being the biggest and industry also contributing. But we are focusing on the diesel engines, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment, but there are standards for new diesel trucks that will make them much cleaner. And then House Bill 2172 focused on reducing emissions from existing diesel engines. So we will be focusing on all parts of that problem.
Mr. Chair, may I make a clarifying point, I think, that might help Representative Girard? The benchmarks that Andy referred to that were adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission are just that. They are benchmarks. on air toxics. They are not federal standards. So there is a difference in the enforcement, if you will. The federal standards, as you heard yesterday, have sanctions if over 4 years or whatever you don't meet them. These are toxic benchmarks that we are trying to reduce to protect people's health. So you're not in that same mode of sanctions.
Thank you. Let's see. So then focusing on policy package 119, it gets directly at this issue we've been talking about, clean diesel, because diesel exhaust is one of the top toxic air pollutants in Oregon, we've really focused on this particular category. And EPA has done a really fantastic job of setting standards for new diesel trucks. So a new diesel truck that was built in 2007, this year or newer, will be as clean as a natural gas vehicle. They've really reduced the emissions significantly. In 2010, new standards come into effect for non-road diesel engines. Those would be everything from construction equipment to generators. And then at some future date, and EPA will be holding hearings on this next week or the week after next, new standards will come into play for trains and barges and other marine engines. So on the new engine side, EPA has done a really good job. The problem is it's similar to the wood stove problem. These diesel engines last for a really long time, 30-plus years. And so all the existing diesel engines out there will be with us for a long time and contributing to the health problems that we talked about. So our focus is really on retrofitting, rebuilding, and replacing the existing diesel engines, as well as reducing idling from those engines. And when you reduce idling, not only do you reduce air toxics, but you also reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So House Bill 2172 is specifically designed to address this problem. And I actually would like to have you look at an illustration here for this one as well. On page 26 of tab C, you can see this is the risk from exposure to diesel engine exhaust in Oregon. And the solid green shows what happens under the federal program while we wait for the new engines to turn over. And in 2017, you can see what we want to accomplish with House Bill 2172 is reduce the risk down to a level of no more than one excess cancer in a million people. And part of the funding to get there will come from federal grants and private contributions, but House Bill 2172 includes a tax credit program to incentivize those private contributions, and also includes funding, and the governor's recommended budget includes $3 million of general fund and limitation for $1.5 million of federal fund to do that work as well. The co-chairs reduced the general fund in for House Bill 2172 to $1 million, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Andy. As far as the reduction from the 3 to 1 million, what does that do to our ability to secure federal funds, matching federal funds?
If you could turn to page 27, that will help me a little bit. On tab C, there you'll see what we can accomplish with different funding levels. And so if you first look at the bar on the left, that shows the total gap that we need to reduce a little over 140 tons per year of diesel emissions above and beyond what's accomplished just by waiting for engines to turn over under the federal program. And so we have to get that much reduction every year for 10 years to get to our goal. And the top part of it that are in all various colors, that's funding that we already have outside of anything the state would contribute. That's funding that's already dedicated to this work. So our gap is the blue slashed area at the bottom of the chart. The governor's recommended budget gets us started on that. You can see at the first bar there, it's labeled $4 million. That's because it's $3 million of general fund plus an estimated approximately $1 million of tax credits. At that level of funding, we would retrofit 193 engines and scrap 323 engines, you can see under that bar. If you reduced under the co-chair's budget, you would reduce that essentially down to $2 million, $1 million of tax credits and $1 million of of grants, and so you'd have approximately one-third of the or somewhere between a half and a third of the reduction.
I know that there is a discussion going on concerning another potential area in the budget where funding may come from. I don't know what level that is now, but numbers I've heard in the past are an additional $1 million. Question I would have is, part of this is, I believe, a $5,000 credit for replacement, or not credit, but actually payment for replacement.
I don't think there's a $5,000 credit.
Not a credit, but I thought there was a...
For scrapping?
Yeah, trucks. Scrapping.
Well, there's no specific dollar amount in the bill, okay. But it does authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to include scrapping as part of the program. And
actually, I just wanted to follow up on Representative Dingfelder, because I don't think we answered your question. I think
Sorry.
Your question was if the amount that the co-chairs is reducing will also reduce the matching ability for the federal dollars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question. The most of the federal dollars are competitive. That is, there's no formula that says if you spend X dollars of state money, you get X dollars of federal money. They're competitive grants. We're competing against California, which is putting 140 some million dollars of their own money into their program. We're competing against Texas and many other states that are trying to get a piece of the federal dollars. Virtually all of the federal grants, maybe not every one, but most of them do have a match requirement. It's not a formula that would say if you put in this much state money, you get that much federal money. It's more a matter of having a program, an overall program that EPA looks at as designed, you know, with the intent of solving the problem, where you've got performance measures, where you've got plans and goals and some state funding. And in that context, they're much more comfortable sending grants our way. And we have been successful already with the program that we have in getting some federal grants. So I think that I don't think it's a given that under the co-chair's budget we'd be less successful in getting federal grants, but I think if having a state program is critical in getting the federal grants.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you for clarifying that. So here's what I'm trying to figure out, a couple things. One is, first of all, on this graph you say annual tons reduced. Is that particulates? Tons of what?
Of diesel particulate.
Okay. And then my question is, with what I'd like to see is a revised FAR. If we are at $1 million for general fund, what does that buy us?
Okay.
And that's what I'm trying to figure out. And then also, I wonder if you could, and I don't know if you're able to do this, factor in if, and certainly I'm hopeful that the biofuels package goes through the Senate. There's the biodiesel standard that would kick in that would have some effect in reducing particulates, and I don't know if you've modeled that or if there's any way you can to look at how that would affect or help with reductions. And then the other is with the new low sulfur diesel coming online, I think it's this year, and I don't know when that kicks in. Does that have any impact as well?
Chair Devlin, Representative Dingfelder, the ultra low sulfur diesel standard went into effect last year in 2006, and it is, I think as you know, low sulfur diesel is just like is to diesel as unleaded gasoline is to gasoline. That is, you can't put the catalyzed particulate traps on unless you have the low sulfur diesel. The sulfur poisons the catalyst. So the first thing EPA did was require nationwide that we have the ultra low sulfur diesel, and then a year later started in with the new trucks meeting the standards. So that's already here and it's already taken into account in all these projections. Biofuels aren't really going to do much for us in terms of reducing particulate emissions. They're naturally low sulfur, so they meet the same sulfur content requirements. So biofuels are 100% compatible with the diesel control technology that we need to put on. But the benefit of of taking the sulfur out, which does reduce the emissions. Also, you get the same thing from biofuels, so it's kind of a wash. So the real benefit of the biofuels is going to be reducing greenhouse gas impacts.
But are you able to revise this so you can give us
yes.
a new bar with a $1 million investment?
We could bring that tomorrow.
Can you give one modification to that? Do it at a million and a half and two,
okay.
because there is some discussion.
Oh, this is already two. The lowest one is two already.
At a million and a half and a million.
And this factors in then the federal grants? Is that correct? That's what I'm trying to.
Yes, we're taking into account. If you see in the first bar, the second chunk there, this little red, those are competitive federal grants we think we can get above and beyond what we've got now.
Representative Dingfelder, is your question whether or not the $4 million at the bottom is the inclusion of $2 million state?
Well, that's not, because that's a biennium, so it's just twice the $2 million. But, yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that doesn't factor in, but how would that fit in? I mean, does that – I'm a little confused by the chart. If it only addresses the federal grant, are we able to then use it for you know, the truck replacement engine program, or is it – just to go towards all those other things that are in the bar chart on the left?
It would be to go towards the part in the blue part of the bar chart on the left. That's the gap. That's where we really want to dedicate our local funding is to addressing the gap. So I will clarify that. I'll bring you a new chart tomorrow.
Helpful.
Representative Berard, then Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
It gave him a promotion.
The motion depending upon
you are my co-chair. Andy, how effective can this program be when two-thirds of the trucks and RVs that are on our highways in Oregon are licensed from out of state?
Senator Deflin and Chair Representative Garrard, actually, most of the emissions come from engines that are in Oregon. When you consider that you've got not just the on-road highway engines that are moving through, but you have all the local delivery engines, and then you've got all the other engines like construction equipment and generators that don't leave the state at all, farm equipment, all those diesel engines out there, most of the emissions really are coming from the non-road sector. So the bill, House Bill 2172, actually has requirements that the funding be targeted towards engines that spend a majority of the time in Oregon. And then we have our neighboring states in Washington and California with similar programs trying to address their engines. And so in a coordinated way, we're going to at least pick up all the I-5 through traffic.
Very good answer. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Berling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Dingfelder's question, if we add $1 million and $1.5 million, et cetera, are we going at all of those levels, are we still going to get the same federal grant, or is that all going to be proportionate based on our investment?
Senator Devlin, Representative Burley, we can't really tell exactly what we'll get on the federal grant because it depends first on how much does Congress appropriate for the program. And the President has requested more funding for this program than Congress appropriated in the past. We're hoping that Congress will appropriate more, but you know the federal budget is experiencing challenges as well. And then once there's an amount appropriated, it's all competitive. So it depends on how our grant does in competition with how our application does in competition with other states. We do have a really well-respected clean diesel program, and House Bill 2172 would give us a leg up in terms of competing for those programs. And as I mentioned, the focus on performance measures is really what catches EPA's eye. When they see us designing to get to a certain risk level, measuring that, tracking performance, and able to tell them for this next increment of grant, this is how it fits into the big picture of getting to our goals, that's what helps us compete for the federal grants. But we can't really be sure how much we'll get because it depends on what other states do and how much Congress is able to appropriate. It won't be gigantic. It's along the lines of what we show there in the red part on the left bar.
One item that I wonder about in this program, Representative Burley, were you?
Yes, thank you.
Is will there be an ability to target certain types
vehicles in the sense of, well, one of them that's been identified is we obviously have some school buses that are diesel. Those probably fit your example of a vehicle that operates, you know, 10 miles or depending upon where. Some of the areas, you know, 10, 20 miles a day. A great example would be if you have a diesel garbage truck, because it's operating literally maybe something like that, 10, 20 miles a day, but it is literally operating for 100 feet at a time in some communities. So it's operating from one place to the next, idling to the next place, idling, versus a long-haul truck that actually isn't going to last 30 years. I mean, I know that diesel engines last longer than they used to. They might be up to a couple million miles right now, but they're not going to last 30 years in a long haul. Do we have the ability to target which vehicles?
Yes, Senator Devlin, the bill gives us that specific authority. It includes cost-effectiveness criteria for issuing grants, and so we would look at the amount of emissions reduced per dollar invested and target the money that way. We also look at the percentage of time that the engine is in Oregon and a number of other factors. So we would be targeting the money towards those places where it gets the greatest benefit. I should mention, though, that the bill was amended along the way to include targets for reducing emissions from school buses specifically. And even though in most cases they don't drive a lot of miles, there's a huge exposure to children and school bus drivers from high-polluting diesel school buses. And there are things we can do for a fairly low cost to at least reduce the exposure of the children inside the bus. Even if we don't retrofit the whole engine, you can prevent some of the emissions from getting inside the passenger area within the bus. So we do want to focus on school buses, even though they may not be the greatest contributor to the outside air quality problem.
Long extension cords.
Final, just Mr. Siebert, does Ways and Means have the bill yet? Do we know?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to check.
Okay.
Revenue, we understand.
Oh, okay. The Senator has
House.
House. We sent it to House.
Okay, sorry. That's a tax credit.
Mr. Chair, I believe the House Revenue Committee has a hearing this Thursday, and they'll have a few amendments on the tax credit portion, and then my understanding is it goes from there to Ways and Means.
It goes from there to the deep hole, is what you're saying.
No comment.
So shall I move on to key budget driver number 3?
Yes.
Be on page 5. This key budget driver is focused on effectively implementing our air quality programs, and this is where all of our fee programs come into play. So we're not thinking about general fund here. As I mentioned, most of air quality's funding comes from dedicated fees. And we operate these programs with a few goals in mind. Our focus is on helping the regulated community comply with the requirements and then ensuring that they comply. And we want to deliver run the program so that it achieves its intended air quality benefits, but at the same time it's run efficiently and we do it with excellent customer service. And so that's the focus of these packages, is to ensure that we have staffing to do that work. Package 112 is focused on the Title V program. Title V is a title of the Federal Clean Air Act. It's a requirement to have an operating permit program. Every state in the nation has one, and it's for the highest emitting industrial facilities. So these are the really largest air pollution sources in the state. Federal law requires that this program be completely funded with fees. We're specifically prohibited from spending general fund or federal funds on this program. And federal law also requires that the fees be adequate to support the program. And we have not had adequate revenue in the last few years. We had to reduce staff. Historically, we operated the program with 36 positions. We lost 3 positions in this current biennium. And as a result, we are now running a backlog in this program for the first time since the program began. We have been streamlining in the program. It's, you can only go so far with streamlining because this is a very prescriptive federal program that says all the steps you have to take to issue a permit. But we have reduced the level of effort required. As a result of that, we think we can run the program with less staff than we had in the past, but more than we have today, if that makes any sense. We have introduced Senate Bill 107, which is designed to increase the Title V fees, and you had a hearing on that last week in this subcommittee, and we described an amendment to that, which you haven't seen yet, but the amendment would phase in the fee increase, and with that amendment, we have support from the regulated community, from AOI, Northwest Pulp and Paper, for the bill, so we're very hopeful that that bill will pass. It's scheduled for a work session on this Thursday in this committee, and I believe we'll have the amendments tomorrow afternoon, this afternoon. If the amendment is adopted, we'll have to revise the policy package to phase in the staff, commensurate with the phase in of the revenue. And then this package would give us the resources that we need to meet our timeliness target. That's the key thing that we're measuring in this program, is that we can issue these permits in a timely way, eliminate the backlog so that when companies need to make a change in their operations, they're not waiting for us to issue a permit. With the phase-in of staff, we will make progress on reducing the backlog in this coming biennium, and we'll completely eliminate it by the end of next biennium.
For his question.
Maybe Stephanie might. This question is directed to your agency is being squeezed not only through cuts over the past number of years, but by these federally mandated FTE requirements of X number of FTEs, et cetera. How much of the pressure on your budget is coming from federally mandated programs that are unfunded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, members of the committee, I have a lovely graphic I can bring you tomorrow that the Environmental Council of the States, which is all the National Association of State Environmental Directors, created, that shows the line of federal regulations going up and the amount of federal funding going down that's coming to states. And I'd be happy to share that with you. It is a nationwide problem. In terms of an actual number, I don't know if I can give you a specific number. I can give you the general picture. A specific number from the current operating budget that we're in this biennium to what our budget would look like if we didn't get the co-chair's budget, if we didn't get the governor's budget, we have a $9.5 million reduction in federal dollars just from the current biennium to with no new resources. And that's pretty indicative of how it's been going. So we actually had an opportunity this year to testify on the Hill to a House Appropriations Committee, and the current president of our association did that, about this phenomenon. And the states as a whole are pushing back pretty hard on EPA on this issue, that if they're going to continue to defund the dollars coming to states, because what's happened is that EPA has been cut for the past X number of years, and they have chosen to take those cuts in the grants they pass through to the states predominantly rather than cut their own budget, but at the same time continuing the regulations going up. So I'll bring you that graphic. We can give you some specifics in each program, but that overall from current biennium to what it looks like without any infusion of general fund. Most of the general fund the co-chairs are providing in their proposed budget offsets losses we're taking on the federal side.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving on to policy package 113 for the asbestos abatement program. The purpose of this program is to prevent exposure to asbestos when there are demolition and remodeling projects. Asbestos causes lung cancer and scarring of the lungs. And historically, this program has been fully funded with fees as well. Recently, we haven't been able to keep up with the cost of the program, partially because of inflation, partially because We've moved on to a larger number of small projects, whereas in the past we had a small number of larger projects, and so our costs are a little bit higher. And so policy package 113 would fund our existing staff, and it would also provide us with one additional position. And the purpose of this position is to do outreach and technical assistance. As I mentioned, we've got a larger number of small projects. Some of these are homeowners. Some of them are small businesses. They're not aware of the environmental regulations the way a larger business would be, and this position would be designed to go out and do the outreach to get to them before they actually have a violation and end up in enforcement. If the package is approved, the Environmental Quality Commission would raise the asbestos abatement notification fee, and that would fund the program. And the fee table would be established by the commission. We don't have that yet. So moving on to policy package 114. This is the Air Contaminant Discharge Permit Program. It's abbreviated ACDP. And this addresses another Clean Air Act requirement. The Clean Air Act requires that every state has to have a construction approval program. So if you have a new air pollution source, it has to be reviewed before construction begins to ensure that it's not going to cause a violation of air quality standards, and then receive a permit before it can begin construction. So obviously, timely issuance of these permits is incredibly important, and we've been tracking this as an Oregon Progress Benchmark number 10A for many years. It's also key performance measure number 2 for DEQ, and so issuance of timely air contaminant discharge permits is really an important economic development tool, as well as an air quality protection tool. We have had a steady decline in revenue in this program since the late 1990s, and we have reduced FTE by 7.5 positions, which is 20% of the staff that we used to have. However, we've been able to keep meeting our timeliness targets because of extensive streamlining that we did in that program. So we're comfortable at the current staffing level in this program that we can continue to meet the timeliness targets. But we have been on a downward trend in timeliness, and we're just slightly under them now. And we've raised the target on ourselves a little bit, so we're going to have to really keep working at it with streamlining to meet them in the future. And we haven't been able to be fully staffed recently because of anticipated shortfalls in revenue for next biennium. So with policy package 114, we would essentially keep the current staffing level. If that package is approved, the Environmental Quality Commission would raise the ACDP fee, and so we would have a steady state in that program, and we'd be able to staff to the level approved in the budget, meet our timeliness targets. And finally, on this key budget driver, we've got the Oregon Low Emission Vehicle Program. This is one of the programs that we adopted to address global warming. The program would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, passenger vehicles, and light trucks. And there are a number of steps that we have to take to implement this program. It goes into effect with cars that are built in 2009 and later. So we're right now, those vehicles will be coming out starting in 2008. So right now we're beginning to gear up the program. We need to get out and do technical assistance with the auto manufacturers and the dealers and the repair shops. We need to manage phase-in procedures that are very important to the manufacturers. And then we're going to need to take steps to ensure compliance in the program. So policy option package 118 requests 1.5 positions to do this work. It will be funded by a fee on the largest auto manufacturers. That fee was included in the rule the Environmental Quality Commission adopted last summer, and almost all of the manufacturers have already paid the first year's fee, so we're confident we'll be getting this revenue. This fee is included in the fee ratification bill, which is House Bill 5023, that will be considered by this subcommittee a little later.
Questions? We'll go about 7 or 8 more minutes, and then
I think I can probably finish, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Our last key budget driver is to provide excellent customer service. And this is obviously important in all of our programs, but it's particularly important in our vehicle inspection program. The purpose of vehicle inspection is to prevent violations of the federal ozone or smog standard. about 1.1 million vehicles are tested each biennium in the Medford and Portland areas. They're required to be tested before they can be registered. And for many Oregonians, vehicle inspection is their only interaction with DEQ, and it colors their view, the service they receive there colors their view of the agency as well as state government as a whole. And that's why we focus so much on customer service. And we do have one of the best run vehicle inspection programs in the country. We receive very few complaints, lots of positive comments, and we're adding to track customer service more carefully. We're adding vehicle inspection to key performance measure number one, starting in the coming biennium, and that measures customer satisfaction. We do a lot of things in vehicle inspection already that the public really appreciates. You can get your vehicle registered right there at our station rather than having to go to vehicle inspection or go to a DMV field office to be registered. We just started accepting debit and credit cards this year, which has been very popular, and we've taken a number of steps to speed up the testing and reduce wait times. For example, you can get on our website and you can see live video of the queue and pick a time when there aren't a lot of cars in line, or pick a station that there aren't a lot of cars in line. And we recently just replaced all of the hardware and software that we use to test with much more efficient and sophisticated equipment. We also were the first state in the country to implement new testing technology called onboard diagnostics. So in the old days, you would put a probe in the tailpipe and measure the emissions. Today, what we do is we download computer information from the car's onboard computer. So the car has sensors that are monitoring to make sure that all of the emission control equipment components are functioning properly, and it stores that information. We download it, and we're able to give a printout to the customer, tell them exactly which component is broken, so it takes the guesswork out of fixing the cars. We were the first state in the nation to switch to that test, and it applies to 1996 and newer vehicles. So we still do a tailpipe test on the older vehicles, but we, as we phased in this new technology, we phased out our most time-consuming tailpipe test. And that has enabled us to significantly reduce staff in this program. We reduced 45 out of 50 limited duration positions that we had in the program, and that has enabled us to run this program for 10 years without raising the fee. In policy package 117, we are requesting that those last five limited duration positions, when they expire at the end of this biennium, that we replace them with permanent positions. That level of staffing is needed to efficiently operate the program. We're also asking for one additional position, which would be an instrument technician, to service the sophisticated computer testing equipment. And this package is funded with the existing vehicle inspection fee. We would not be increasing the fee to fund this. And then I'll just briefly mention that we have a number of other new improvements that are in the works. We have recently completed the nation's first self-service test lane. So it's just like when you go to the grocery store and check out yourself, you'll be able to do that on vehicle inspection. We have one lane that's up and operating now that we're still finishing, so that right now when you go in there, an inspector helps you, but ultimately you'll be able to go in after hours and test your own car. And that would be very convenient for people who are do-it-yourselfers. Our plan next biennium would be to expand that so we can put self-service test lanes out in a shopping mall, for example, so you can test your car, you know, while you're doing your shopping. We also have created the first online testing option, and this is another outgrowth of the computer technology. So instead of driving your car to a test center and having us test it, you can actually download the data to us over your computer, basically take a little box that we would provide you with, plug it into your computer, and download the data to us over the internet. Then we will send you back an email telling you that you passed the test, and then you can get on DMV's online system and register online.
Okay. Representative Garag has been waiting a while, and then Representative Berlin.
I have two questions, if I can.
Yeah. Mr.
Chair. Number one, Andy, can you explain to me, here I have a district that's out of containment air quality-wise, but I don't have a vehicle inspection DEQ in Klamath Falls, and I don't have any requirements. This is one of those things, as Representative Burley just said, don't pray too hard because you might get it. But I don't understand, if we have an air quality problem, why don't you put some restrictions on our vehicle emissions?
Senator Devlin, Representative Garrard, the vehicle inspection program is most effective at helping meet the smog standard and the carbon monoxide standard, and it's not really that important in terms of particulate. We don't have, there is a small amount of particulate that comes from passenger cars, from gasoline engines, but it's really a very minor source. So the trade-off and the cost involved in setting up a vehicle inspection program, for example, in Klamath Falls, for the amount of emission reduction benefit wouldn't pay off.
Which we just got out of the carbon monoxide thing a couple of years ago. Second question, Mr. Chair. A couple sessions ago, I went with Representative Crummell to a DEQ inspection station locally, and we found that out of the three lanes in the vehicle inspection, one lane had a continually high percentage of not in compliance, while the other two lanes, and they did all kinds of experiments, etc. Have you, A, was there a problem, and have you corrected that?
Senator Devlin, Representative Garrard, there was a problem in one lane. There was some debris that had got sucked into the test hose, and it was testing incorrectly. That was fixed a long time ago, and that test we eliminated, so we couldn't ever have that problem again because we don't do that test anymore.
Senator Devlin, the only thing I would ask is offer is that Representative Burley's district is with the monitor at 3rd and Greenwood might be more at risk for vehicle inspection.
Mr. Chair,
well, if they do that, then you can get all of the bills to exempt certain areas out of it that I have to deal with for 10 years. So, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Stephanie, again, I want to thank you. You know, several years ago when Ochoco Lumber closed their mill and salvaged it off, they ran into some asbestos issues, and your office in Eastern Oregon was extremely helpful and responsive, and we really appreciate the efforts. Question on this vehicle inspection thing, and no, I would really rather not see it again, but
I'm ready to be chief co-sponsor with you.
No, thank you. These fees have been paying for this program all along, correct?
Yes.
So if we're going to get rid of 20 limited duration FTEs and reduce that down to just the 6 that you need to run it, how much additional revenues are being accumulated through these fees that we're not using to pay for the FTEs?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, the reduction in FTE is what's enabled us to avoid a fee increase. The program is going to just be able to cover its costs, including the cost of installing these new technologies that I talked about in the next biennium.
I would state, Representative Burley, having a little bit of background in this area in previous sessions, the limited duration position, which are the inspectors, I think are about in some of the lowest pay ranges for current state employees.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
The other thing, if I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, I think it's important to note that revenue is being used to pay for new technology. So it's not as if there's just a big bank account of fees sitting there. And we could actually give you this pretty impressive. This is, to me, a good example of the state actually being proactive to look forward and install technology in a way that has saved money and saved having to hire additional staff. So that's where the investment has been. It's not been in the bodies. It's been in the technology.
And our original projection when we adopted the fee in 97 was that it would last for 5 years, and it's been over 10. Mr. Chair, if I could have 20 seconds, I could finish.
20 seconds.
Okay. The last technology I just need to mention briefly is rather than downloading the data from your computer to DEQ, we would like to offer another option where you can actually, the data would actually broadcast to us. So if you opt into this program, you never have to touch the computer or the car. We'll just send you a notice if there's a problem with your car, and you just keep it repaired. We will be putting in two new test centers in the coming biennium. We're replacing our Sherwood station, has some safety issues, and we're planning on relocating our Northeast station, and this would be combined with the DMV field office. And our idea is one-stop shopping where you could go in and get all your DMV and DEQ work done in one place. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm finished.
A little bit of Orwellian overtones.
Back to Miles while you're at it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, could we get a bit of clarification on what you would like to cover tomorrow so I would make sure I have the right people here?
We're through with air quality.
Thursdays are the two.
We have Senate Bill 107, if I'm correct, and I think is the e-waste bill tomorrow as well?
E-waste. And how many more days do we have for consideration of DEQ?
Mr. Chairman of this committee, you would have Monday and Tuesday and then Wednesday set aside for public testimony.
Okay.
Would you like us to start water tomorrow?
You can't.
Can't.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I would just plan on those. We may take a shorter period of time tomorrow, but that should be fine. 107, I anticipate some discussion, but I don't expect that consideration to be that lengthy. The e-waste may take a little bit longer.
I'll be here tomorrow morning.
You will be here?
I will not be here tomorrow morning.
Okay, I'll just have to make sure that I've got a quorum on the other side. But e-waste, we're trying to keep the testimony sort of focused and realizing that it's already had consideration in policy committees. And so far, there's been no discussion of any amendments coming forward that actually will come to the committee. But I know. But I think we just have to be prepared that it could take a little bit longer. But if we're through in 45 minutes, I still think we have plenty of time on Monday and Tuesday to finish up. And then the public testimony on Wednesday. It would probably be helpful to the chair if you could talk to Paul and see what kind of testimony we're expecting on Wednesday. We've been actually pretty good, been able to accommodate almost everybody that's shown up, literally everybody that's shown up. But sometimes we've had 5 people, and other times we've had 25 people on a budget. So be pretty good. Be good.
Probably
to know.
Be between those two numbers somewhere would be my guess.
Okay.
But we'll do that, Mr. Chair.
And with that, and with my full committee still here, I will close both public hearings and close the committee.